Dein altes Sofa zerfällt langsam und die Black-Friday-Angebote sind wirklich unschlagbar. Aber dein Gehalt kommt erst Anfang des Monats. Kein Problem, mit der PayPal-Bezahlung nach 30 Tagen. So hast du jetzt mehr Spielraum beim Bezahlen und der Betrag wird nach 30 Tagen automatisch und kostenlos von deinem Konto oder deiner Karte abgebucht. Alle Infos auf paypal.de/30 Tage. PayPal es. Vorbehaltlich Kreditwürdigkeitsprüfung verfügbar mit deutschem PayPal-Konto für Einkäufe zwischen 1 und 2.000 Euro.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Cap Bailey. My lovely co-host, Nadia, is not with me this week. Instead, I have a special guest here to talk to me about all things Mass Effect and also a little bit of Torment Tides of Numenera. Yes, believe it or not, this podcast does occasionally cover Western RPGs. The Blood God is not just a JRPG fan. The Blood God does not just play Persona. No, we are going to be talking about Torment Tides of Numenera, and Mass Effect, and who better to do that than Rowan Kaiser, who specializes in this sort of thing. Rowan reviewed Torment Tides of Numenera for us over on the site. You can go check out his review, and he also wrote a Mass Effect essay for us, and he's just started in on Andromeda. And Rowan, I think you're also writing a book, if I'm not mistaken, about Mass Effect. How's that going? Or is that like kind of like something I shouldn't be asking about?
I mean, this month is giving me more motivation to get back into it. I was hoping to have it done before Andromeda, but I ended up having to write a Game of Thrones book beforehand, and then, But, yes, I am very slowly writing a Mass Effect book and getting several new pieces in.
Very nice.
This month.
Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about your book really quickly?
The book is called Possibility Space, which is kind of a dorky title, but it ends up working really well because I think that what makes Mass Effect special is the gap between what it wants to do and what it's actually doing. And I think this is true for most ambitious RPGs, but Mass Effect, because it's so heavily serialized and because it's so high in production value, gets a lot closer at actually succeeding and making you want to jump into its spaces and let it take you over than most of them, even though it's filled with all these very, very obvious problems. And, you know, that tension between things that are obviously not quite what they should be and the player's willingness to let that go is, I think, what makes it so interesting to me. So it's not even, like, my favorite games of all time, but they're some of my favorite games to write about.
We had an argument on Twitter some time ago about Mass Effect's overall significance, and I was arguing that it was significant for its time, but that it dropped off a lot, and you're arguing pretty heavily that Mass Effect is one of the like more significant games of the past 20 years. I think that there's room for both those arguments, but maybe we'll get into them a little bit later when we talk about the original trilogy. For now, let's talk briefly about Torment Tides of Numenera, which unfortunately came out at kind of the worst possible time. It came out, I think, almost like basically like 3 days before the Switch. And even though Torment and the Switch have very different audiences, I feel like it immediately got buried in the mainstream press and like kind of just, oh, and it came out, if I'm not mistaken, the review embargo for Torment came out, went up the same day, like maybe as Horizon Zero Dawn.
Yeah, I think it was like within a day of Horizon, and also it was the embargo was release, and release was like the second day of GDC. So I think there's probably some press attention that it could have gotten in some different directions.
Yeah, maybe if it had come out like a month from now, maybe the press would have given it a lot more attention than it ultimately got, which is kind of sad because it seemed like you really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think it's got a lot of really interesting and really competent ideas in kind of the throwback Not necessarily the combat-driven throwback like a Wasteland or a Pillars, but the sort of throwback conversation-based RPG. Tyranny came out a few months ago that fits very much in that same sort of genre. Mm.
Yes, Brian Fargo said that Brian Fargo came on the podcast, I think about 2 months ago now, and he was talking a lot about how conversations to him are what drive RPGs, and he wanted to significantly deprioritize the combat in this game, much as it was in Planescape Torment. I always find it really interesting because so many RPGs put so much emphasis on the combat systems first, with conversation being almost kind of it's an important thing, it's an important driver of the story, but it's like a secondary consideration. But here in Torment, it's a primary consideration.
Right, and it's also even merged. Like, the combat in Tides of Numenera is called a crisis, and you can have crises that are entirely about talking to people. You can have crises that are entirely about smashing robots. You can have crises that can be resolved in both ways. You can have one that's like two parties are ready to fight and you can go and try and talk them down, or you can just take a side and beat them up. There's even one that's kind of you use conversation to distract someone while you're hacking a thing on the other side of the screen, which is probably better in theory than it is in practice, but it is a really neat idea, and it largely works.
Yeah.
It just gets a little boring at times.
Yeah, you were saying, the thing that I find the most interesting about Torment Tides of Numenera, aside from, obviously it is the spiritual successor to a very, very popular and beloved RPG, is that it gives you so many options, for being able to, deal with a wide variety of problems. Let's see if I can, you give, one really good example in your review, and I'm, trying to open that up right now.
Yeah.
But it was actually pretty crazy, the number of options that you could actually do. But here's just an example. You got a quest that you open up an organic portal in this living city called the Bloom, right? If I'm not mistaken, the Bloom is the one with the monsters, the plant monsters or something like that. Am I wrong about that?
No, it's the one that we played at the preview. I don't know if you actually played it or just talked to people at the preview, actually. But if you played it, that was the Bloom.
All right.
But yes.
So the portal feeds on guilt, and you can feed it a non-player character who owes you a favor, or you can browbeat a party member into doing your will and taking the plunge. You can convince an accused criminal to prove their innocence in front of it. You can find a crashed ship's AI programmed to feel guilt about failing its passengers and take it into your head and give it to the Bloom. Or you can just cut the thing open, which I think is pretty great. I like that you can go to so many different characters and be like, hey, you, why don't you go in there?
Cutting the thing open also requires having done a quest previously.
Yeah.
So it's all these different interconnected concepts that it's not just here's the thing with the cool idea and then you just pick a random side of it. It's also whether you turn left or turn right coming out of the opening screen of the little Nihilus, something like that. Whether when you walk into this little town, if you turn right, you go into the area that has that ship AI. And that's also the area where you can charge up the sword that will let you cut through the trans-dimensional portals. If you turn left, then you go straight to the portal first, and you might not even realize that it feeds on guilt initially unless you have, the right set of skills. If you go straight, then you run into that criminal that you can feed to it, or you run into the guy who gives you the quest that says, go figure out how this portal works, or the resolution of a different quest, which is a girl who, once you help her, will tell you, has the ability to tell you how these portals work. And she's also one of the ones that you can convince to feed to it. So it's not just, here's the cool thing, it's here's the cool thing that will totally change just depending on what direction you go and talk to people. Because, usually you're okay, I can solve this puzzle. I know who I can give to this thing. But if you actually, sit down and look at all of it, it's a pretty amazing combination of things that make up the sort of quest hubs for the game.
Yeah, it's great. And sadly, like, this kind of conversation, like, this kind of focus on conversation almost feels like a lost art, especially in a lot of, like, more modern AAA RPGs. Like, everybody was definitely lamenting the loss of more complex conversations in Fallout 4. And you're seeing a lot of the similarities in Mass Effect Andromeda, where I would not, like, I do not pine for the return of the Paragon and Renegade system, but they did bring with them a distinct sense of consequences to a lot of your actions, and that it was nice to be able to unlock, like, new dialogue choices and that kind of thing. And that aspect is, like, more or less absent from Mass Effect Andromeda, which is, like, definitely missed. Whereas in Torment Tides of Numenera, like, not only do you have that, but one of the things that I find really great is that there are dialogue choices that you can unlock, but it's not a matter of, like, oh, I put enough points into this one stat and now it is open, and by the way, if I use this, this is always going to resolve a situation favorably for me. It's like, if I'm not mistaken, you can put points into a dialogue option on the fly, is that right?
Yeah, well, if they're things where you're, like, trying to convince someone, yes. Mm-hmm. And this is a system that is true for most of the skills you use in the game, including every time you attack in combat. So, again, it's another thing where the combat and conversation and sort of general play of the game is integrated. But you can basically, your skill point, or your attributes, which are might, speed, and intellect, are not, they're not like core abilities that say, you know, you have an 18 might, you're the strongest person alive. They are, you have 18 might points, and you can use these to gamble your might when you're trying to do might-based actions. And I am forgetting the term that's used for them in the game, but, you know, it's a skill check. But you can use these points to, each one increases your chances by 20%. So you're talking to a guy that you're trying to intimidate, and maybe the sort of background skills you have give you a 45% chance of intimidating him. But you toss in two might points, now it's an 85% chance. But that can still fail. Like, that's got a 15% chance of failing. And in most games with kind of skill checks, if you have an 85% chance at something and you fail, and it's like a conversation option that you really want to see the answer to, a lot of Obsidian games do this. Fallout New Vegas, I think, is the one that comes immediately to mind. That just makes me want to reload. Like, I don't see that as a like positive end result. But when you're gambling in Torment, you're saying, I'm only putting 2 points to get this to 85%, so I am taking responsibility for how much of a chance I have at this. And if I didn't put it up to 100% and I fail, that's on me. Mm-hmm. That's just on me.
Mm-hmm.
And they also specifically in their loading screen say that failing sometimes creates more interesting states than succeeding at these things. So another thing that I think is important to talk about with this game is that it's not just that it's written well, it's that it's planned well, and there's a lot of writing for all kinds of different possibilities. They basically put the effort into it to make stuff like skill checks failing or having 6 different resolutions for each quest. They did the work. It's not just, oh wow, this is so creative and neat. It's they put in the time to make sure that this stuff all ends up, you know, interconnecting. And that reminds me of The Witcher 3, which is a game that, like, doesn't do anything especially new. It just does all the things that it does really, really well and makes sure they all come together.
Yes, the execution in that game is fantastic.
Yeah, so it sort of seems like that, even though they're very different games and kind of scope and action and amount of combat and their styles of exploration, but they both put in the work, and they're two of the Western RPGs that people are going to be talking about from these few years, I think, for a while.
Well, sadly, it does end a little abruptly, though, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that was my big problem with it, was that it's it's not quite like a it's definitely not a KOTOR 2 level of just we forgot the ending or we ran out of money and we're not allowed to actually end this game. It's probably not even quite a Dragon Age 2 level of this is really rushed, we couldn't make everything come together, but it is a really fast ending. You have like these two huge, beautiful, awesome hubs in Sagis Hills, or Sagis Cliffs, which is the first zone, then there's kind of a middle big climax, and then you have the Bloom, which is the second huge zone. And then there is another big climax, and it's done in like 45 minutes, whereas you can spend like 6, 10, 12 hours exploring the Bloom. And it's also based on this, the politics of kind of the premise of the game, where there is this changing god who uses and discards bodies every decade or so, and you are the most recent of these bodies. These bodies are still alive and they're still people. And they're all very powerful people who have their own kind of internal politics. There's a thing called the Eternal Conflict? God, I don't think that's right. But there's an eternal war between the Changing God's forces and his first cast-off's forces. And all of the cast-offs who are into kind of the cast-off community, like, have to pick a side, or very deliberately not pick a side in this big conflict, and at the very end it kind of starts resolving that for you and gets into cast-off politics in a way that I don't think it's set up through the rest of the game very well. The rest of the game has set up kind of exploring these zones, talking to the regular people, a few of whom are cast-offs and a few of whom aren't, but in the end it's just all this stuff that has been there but has not been prioritized, and I think it would be really interesting if it had been given more time and space to prioritize.
It's the thing with Torment, though, is like you could see like how like they were kind of tweaking it like heavily throughout. Like if you looked at the initial like early access rollout, where a lot of people like had in particular a lot of issues with the beginning and that kind of thing. Which happens with a lot of games, but like having that process kind of in the open really lays bare like the amount of work that went into kind of pulling it together into what it is like now. And I mean, I guess at a certain point they just had to get the thing out, right?
Yeah, it's having to get it out. It's also the games where your choices, like, all your choices matter and build on each other. Like, ending those is really hard because you kind of have to just stop with that. And that can feel really abrupt. So games like Dragon Age 2, games like Alpha Protocol, games like Tyranny are all fairly famous for having these just kind of crashing into a wall kind of endings. And this one is probably better than most of those. Maybe not Tyranny, but it's not like a super confusing ending and like, why did this just happen? It's like, oh, this is how we're doing this. I guess that's fine. But yeah, you can also see kind of that it feels like a this has to be out the door budget kind of thing. I read one article about how initially the second hub that they had planned was this kind of underwater village that is referred to in the text of the game many times beforehand. You have these moments where you like go into other people's memories that turn into kind of a text adventure or a Twine game kind of thing. And more than one of these takes place in this underwater village. And this was supposed to be the second hub, but they said in the article, oh, we fell in love with the idea of the Bloom. It fit like what we wanted to do with the game at this point. And they're right too. The Bloom is a really interesting idea and really good hub for quests, but this underwater village appears as like a single screen part of the ending that you kind of interact with vaguely in it's difficult to describe enough without getting into spoilers, but it's there, it exists. They're like, we had this in the initial pitch and we decided to go a different direction, but it's still there and you'll be happy with it. And like, if all you wanted to see was an underwater village, that's fine. But if you wanted to like hang out in the underwater village for longer than 10 minutes, then it's probably going to be a disappointment. But that sort of indicated to me just how, they'd run into difficulties, and the ending was probably rushed because of that. And, you know, that's... We talked about my book earlier. That's taken years longer than I had hoped, mm-hmm. and this game takes years longer than I had hoped, and that is a problem that you have when you crowdfund sometimes, is that you have a really good idea that kind of gets away from you, and I think this did a little bit from them, and it's forgivable in this case. That's a bit of a mess at the end, but when the rest of it is strong enough, I think it works.
So looking across, like, Pillars of Eternity, Tyranny, Torment Tides of Numenera, and Wasteland 2, like, kind of the most recent run of isometric RPGs, like, the new wave of isometric RPGs, like, where do you think it falls? Do you feel like it kind of is one of the stronger of the bunch, or does it fall kind of, like, in the middle of the pack? Where do you see it?
I mean, I think I haven't given enough time to Wasteland 2. I'd also add Divinity Original Sin.
Oh, yes. Right. Yeah, Divinity Original Sin. It's a little different, but yeah, I would definitely put it in there. It's technically an isometric RPG.
Yeah, it's an Ultima and not a Baldur's Gate, but some of us prefer Ultima.
Some of us prefer Ultima, yes.
Some of us do. Well, I think the last time you had me on was discussing my distaste for the Infinity Engine, so, yeah.
People responded well to that one.
Oh, people.
Yes.
I think that this is probably the one that may get the most, and perhaps because it came out at a easy-to-look-over point, it won't get that initially, but over time I think this one might get the most kind of mainstream attention as this might be how RPGs are going to look. This one might be, you know, these skill checks can be applied to an RPG of any kind of perspective or funding class or whatever. It's got, and you know, the way that I compared the writing to The Witcher 3, which is very clearly a different sort of RPG, but it's the sort of thing that you could say, now I see how they put all these things together, and I could do that in my game, or I can't, because, you know, I have too much voice acting recorded and can't edit on the fly like I might need to. But you can see kind of these structures that can be taken and made into different kinds of games, so I think it's likely to be one of the more influential among them, and I think it's definitely not weaker as a game than most of them. So I think we're looking at one of the most likely to be discussed in 5 years of all of those.
Okay, interesting. I would say that Pillars of Eternity probably has the best chance, in my mind, of being the one that is discussed in 5 years or whatever. But maybe you're right in that Torment Tides of Numenera is kind of the most forward-thinking of them, where, like, Pillars of Eternity is more of a throwback. So there is that aspect, for sure. By the way, like, just really quickly, like, give me, like, your 30-second opinion on Tyranny.
Tyranny is, I think, a bunch of really interesting kind of peaks of Obsidian's design of trying to make sure all your characters, all your factions, and all your conversations and all your combats all come together in being changing the same kind of game world or making it or whatever. And I think it largely succeeds at that. It does it within the Infinity Engine, which I'm not the world's biggest fan of. And I might, you know, rush a little bit coming towards the end. So it's still an Obsidian game in that it's a little janky, but I think it's got one of the best faction character choices matter ideas of any game that I have seen. It's kind of like, what if they didn't have to put Fallout New Vegas out 6 months early or whatever?
Right.
So it's kind of the peak of that.
Yeah, it was. I wish that I had more time to play Tyranny because, if I recall correctly, much like Torment Tides of Numenera, it kind of came out at a bad time for me. I seem to recall that it came out right on top of another big game that I was reviewing that fall. Might have been Final Fantasy 15, even. So,
yeah, it came out in like October, so there were like 10 different games that could have been.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, it just, the timing was not very good for me, unfortunately, but. All right. So, Rowan, let's talk a little bit about Mass Effect Andromeda, which is out now. It came out on Tuesday as of the recording of this podcast. I reviewed it. I gave it a 3 out of 5 in my review. I had some pretty significant problems with some of its design choices, among other things. You just started it. And yep. I want to be clear, as I will say in this podcast title, we're not going to do spoilers here, so you don't have to worry about anything. Like, we'll outline like the basic premise of the game. Spoiler alert, they go to Andromeda. But other than that, so you have played about 5 hours, Rowan, and you've done kind of the opening hours. The opening hours came in for a rough time among a lot of like publications, like RPS in particular came down particularly hard on it. What are your thoughts as a longtime Mass Effect fan?
Well, first of all, I could see why people have come down on it. The scenes when you go into the Nexus, which is the Citadel wannabe, are just remarkably poorly put together compared to like everything else in all three previous Mass Effects. Mm. You've seen the videos of like the opening scene when you kind of meet the director and one of the other important people, and there's like these 3-second pauses between every line, and yeah, it's bizarre that this. It's bizarre to feel this. I just replayed all three of the previous games, and there was never a scene or set of scenes like that in all of them. There were ones that were kind of awkward and ones that were kind of poorly written, but none that just seemed to get everything wrong quite like going into that Nexus initially. So I can see why people were especially down on it, but other conversations are fine, and
mm-hmm.
Like, I think the Nexus is kind of ugly, but then I go down to the alien worlds, and the alien worlds are beautiful, and I just, it's, at least the first one. I spent some time on the desert planet, which obviously is a desert, is a little less interesting than the initial.
There are 2 desert planets.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
It's the Dragon Age Inquisition of...
But there are also some other planets. I mean, they, like... You know, they go pretty tropey with their planets. There's the jungle planet and the ice planet and the, irradiated asteroid planet. And some of them are great. Like, I think the ice planet is really phenomenal. And I actually also really enjoyed the irradiated asteroid, which is just a number to be, actually. I think that the initial planet is actually maybe one of the more boring of them.
You mean the initial desert planet?
Yes, Eos.
Yes. Because there's a Habitat 7 that's this weird alien world. It's like the first time you actually get to start running around and shooting things.
That mm-hmm.
looks really neat. And then you go to Eos, and that's when you start driving your little Jeep around.
Yes, the Nomad. But what do you think of that? Like, are you kind of in... Like I'm of two minds of the Nomad, because on the one hand it's cool just to drive around, and I actually really am a big fan of the terrain, because just the really varied and interesting terrain keeps it kind of from being boring, because you're always having to kind of negotiate around all of these interesting obstacles. Like getting from point A to point B isn't that boring, but like when I think about it, like, I mean, there's not actually that much on these planets. Like, you'll see, you know, you can mine a little bit. You'll run into enemy camps, which are basically just bandit camps. But by and large, like, otherwise, it's kind of empty-ish. But it's interesting because I didn't necessarily feel the emptiness, if you kind of catch my drift.
Yeah, like, if it's channeling you in the right directions, if you can get what you want out of going into these directions, then maybe it won't feel that empty. Or if you only have to go the once, then, you know, it doesn't necessarily. But if it's a thing where you end up going in the same directions over and over, driving around in circles or backtracking or so on, that's the sort of thing that can feel extra empty over time.
Right.
The thing that I am worried about, as I've just found the crafting systems and so on, is how the item itemization and progression in that direction works, because it's throwing a bunch of stuff at me, and I'm not sure what's most important. I'm not sure if I should be mining the hell out of everything I see.
Here's the deal. The each planet has kind of specific minerals, and you kind of have to visit them all to be able to get what you want. So I had a ton of, like, I had a ton of minerals, right? Like, I didn't even have to, like, go scanning around very much. Most of the time I would arrive in a system, I would scan, there would be an artifact, I would go to it. Often the artifact in just a system would give me a bunch of good stuff. But it wasn't until the latter half of the game that I was really able to craft anything, because I was always missing one thing. And it was really annoying, actually. And finally, I went to the irradiated asteroid that I was just mentioning, and it gave me everything I needed for the stupid Milky Way stuff. And I was like, oh, thank God, finally. But of course, by that time, I had already been able to find a lot of stuff just from loot and that kind of thing. So it wasn't as interesting. I think probably the most interesting aspect of the crafting system are the augmentations, which you can use to kind of change the nature of the weapons into like more of explosive kind of stuff, or turn them into like an energy, like lightning beam, or into like just a straight up like energy weapon, which is actually kind of weak, but I digress. So I think maybe just the balance and the pacing of the crafting system is a little bit off.
Yeah, this is one of my problems with Dragon Age Inquisition, was that it actually had one of the better crafting systems that I have seen in an RPG. I am generally opposed to crafting systems, but it also had a weird thing where you could buy your loot or you could find your loot, and figuring out exactly like which one you were supposed to be focusing on in order to get your characters in the best position was not exactly confusing or not exactly apparent, and was quite rather confusing. And Andromeda, I'm sort of getting that feeling that if I can buy the weapons and have to research and craft the weapons and do all those things, it makes it hard to figure out what the focus should be. But what you say about how each planet has something makes it seem like they have kind of put together an idea of how to go about doing all of these itemization progression.
Mm-hmm.
They just might not tell you.
Mm-hmm. It's a little opaque. There's a lot going on, but then you kind of realize, like later in the game, and I alluded to this in my review, that there's a lot going on, but if you think about it for like half a second, you realize it's not actually that deep at all.
Does it do the BioWare thing where once you do the kind of initial pseudo-tutorial planet, then you can go to any of the others, or is the progression linear?
It's a bit more gated. What happens is it opens up a couple more planets, and you can choose where you want to go. But you can, I believe, like just kind of like leave the planet and go to either one. But the main point is that you complete like one of the fairly majorish quests that it gives to you, and that kind of opens up a bit more, and you can go to other planets. And it's around this time that you'll just kind of get a whole slew of like quests from your crew members, from the Nexus, that, you know, around that kind of thing. And the next thing you know, like, you're kind of, like, jaunting all over the Helios cluster and just doing a lot of stuff. And actually, my favorite thing about Mass Effect Andromeda is that there's... I think that the side quests actually feel fairly substantial, because a lot of them are actual quest chains. And they're heavily story driven rather than go fetch the thing kind of driven, which kept me kind of invested in them. And I think actually the loyalty missions work pretty well in particular. It really seems like the designers kind of cut loose in particular with the encounter designs and that kind of thing. So unfortunately, like, I kind of had to just keep pressing on to actually finish the game. And I found the main quest very weak at the end of the day. But I think that if you are just kind of taking your time and being leisurely about it, you can have a fair amount of fun just like getting lost down the rabbit holes of doing these individual quests, some of which are in a way almost like think pieces of like, well, okay, you're in the Andromeda cluster and like you've been on the road for 600 years and what would happen if this happened or what would happen if that happened, or let's talk about these crazy people about why they decided to come out here. And as a sci-fi nerd, I'm like, oh, that's kind of interesting.
One of the things that I have noticed in terms of the story is that while I'm seeing what you and other people have complained about, that Andromeda itself is not particularly alien in a way that they could have done, the kind of pioneer mentality and the motivations of the characters, kind of the internal drive that has people out in Andromeda, is pretty motivating and well put together in most cases. So I think that it's getting that half of the sci-fi nerd itch scratched for me, but it's not necessarily getting the here's everything we could possibly have done with this new galaxy. Like, I mean, I just look at the premise and you could have like a Star Trek Voyager, a Battlestar Galactica style thing where you're on the run from a totally hostile universe, or you could just find a totally new and weird and diverse universe that's like the original Mass Effect but with a bunch of new aliens, but they just kind of split the middle with that, then it's not terribly exciting.
Yeah, I almost wish that the humans had been the only ones to set out for this new galaxy with maybe like, you know, a Turian and an Asari and a Krogan rather than all of them. Because the old races dominate the story in a lot of respects, like to the exclusion almost of the new guys. Like, the new guys aren't interesting at all. I barely even thought about the Angarans. It's kind of the worst of both worlds, to be honest. Like, on the one hand, I wouldn't have minded them like discovering a totally alien, totally different, like a race that is totally inscrutable and you can't really figure out what the heck they are, but they are trying to kill you, and you're like, and trying to figure out like what the heck is going on with them. Or barring that, you know, like I wouldn't have minded walking right into a fully established ecosystem with like existing rivalries, and you can kind of like maybe having a lot more of a gray area going on with the races that you're discovering. And them going, oh, we have a wild card here in our existing conflicts. Well, you can come join with us. No, come join with us. And you're like trying to figure out, it's like, oh crap, do I like throw off the balance of power in this entire like area that I just kind of walked into? Or do I try to split the difference and then have them both hate me? Like, I think that with a bit of like maybe time and also creativity, that it could have been a lot more interesting, but ultimately it wasn't.
I mean, it's possible that they could move that direction in the sequels if they hear enough from us. Like, this one seems to be very specifically focused on one part of the galaxy, and I don't know, maybe they can figure something out. Because it has a relatively limited scope, they can kind of flip things on their head. After all, that is sort of the tradition in the series to do with the second game.
That would be nice, especially because it feels like there's a huge amount of room to grow. Like, what they show is so kind of limited that it just feels like, okay, well, great. Like, this is, like, one tiny, like, aspect. And as I already, like, said, the Milky Way races and, like, their dynamics end up completely subsuming, like, anything that's really interesting about the Andromeda Galaxy. So I would like them, if they do make a sequel and they do kind of double down on the setting, which I imagine they would, I don't know why they wouldn't, I would hope that they would go a lot more into depth into the new setting than they did in this initial go around.
One thing that you mentioned briefly was that having the time to go into all the side quests and stuff was actually good, and I've seen a bunch of people complaining about the embargo on this sucker, so maybe with it out in the wild and everyone able to look at every part of it instead of just that ugly ass Nexus, people will sort of turn in a more positive direction.
I don't know, all people are doing right now, like, I'm like looking on the various subreddits and like social media and stuff, and literally all people are doing are posting awkward like animations and stuff.
Yeah, the animations are occasionally an issue. There are some characters whose faces just don't seem to be on their bodies right. They're always looking in the wrong direction, and it's really off-putting. Like, I can see why people are upset about that. Like, I'm sort of getting enough of a science fiction nerd push that I can look past it for now, but this is one of the things with the original trilogy is that I was able to do that with all three games up until the very, very end of it, but there are a bunch of points where people fell off that willingness to suspend their disbelief with, in Mass Effect 1, whether it was the janky-ass combat, Mass Effect 2, whether it was the sudden turn into Gears of War and Darkness, or the crazy boss at the end, or Mass Effect 3's ending, or the beginning is also not terribly good. But there's usually something about each of them that would make some people fall off that they will not stop arguing about.
Mm-hmm.
And there are probably a lot more places where they can fall off, at least in the initial part of Andromeda. And that's weird, because in some ways it feels like this is a sequel to Mass Effect 1 and not 2 and 3.
A little bit, yeah. Like, they're definitely... I think that they had in their mind to be like, well, everybody always said that Mass Effect 1 was a very interesting but also very flawed game, so maybe we can, like, kind of make good on that promise. Like, that was one of their, like, big talking points, was like, we are, like, making good on the promise of Mass Effect 1. But...
they made it extra flawed and extra interesting, I guess.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, when I look back on Mass Effect 1, like, if you haven't already, like, to those people who are listening, like, you should go check out the three essays that we posted on each of the three games. We have one for one, two, one for two, and one for three. The last one was written by Rowan, by the way. And like, Doc was talking a lot about the kind of interesting things that Mass Effect 1 does. And I actually found myself thinking a lot about Mass Effect 1 as well while playing Andromeda. And I was kind of lamenting that there's just nothing as interesting, for example, as the kind of the final battle of the original Mass Effect, where you're battling on the outside of the Citadel, and meanwhile there's a space battle going on around you, and like, you have a choice that you can essentially like wipe out the alien console, and then you can make the bad guy shoot himself in the head with like a speech check. And there's just like so much going on, and there's some like interesting thematic stuff. And yeah, in some respects, it's boilerplate sci-fi, but it just feels so much more, I don't know, it feels smarter than what Andromeda does, which I mean, it honestly feels a little bit like Star Trek Voyager.
Yeah, that's the downside of the trying something new, is sometimes you try something a little more new than your writers can handle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that this is a discussion we had on Twitter a little bit, is that one of the really exciting things about Mass Effect 1 was the way it directly engaged with classic science fiction literature, to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it opens with, like, here's a giant homage to Startide Rising, and then there are very specific moments that go into, like, Hyperion and Grass. These are some classic science fiction literature from the 80s that you should check out. And I, in all the discussions of Andromeda, I'm not seeing, like, things that people are talking about that kind of connects Andromeda to this classic science fiction that allows me to, well, it allows the writers to kind of say, we know this works. We know this story is something that we can get right, because other people have gotten it right. For example, the Thorian on Pharos, the sort of giant plant that undergirds this entire world and can psychologically control the ecosystem above it, is sort of the premise of the novel Grass by Sherry S. Tepper, and it's a really good book. And it's like, when that clicked for me, oh, they're doing that here. It's like, oh, each of these little stories is a different vignette that takes on a different thing, and from a story that works, and you know, that all comes together. And when I look at Andromeda, I see mostly people comparing it to previous Mass Effects, So it's like their influences are the thing they did that was influenced by other people, but it's not necessarily the other influences that maybe don't appear in visual science fiction all that often. And I asked you about this, and your response was a little underwhelming to me.
You know, Prometheus and Interstellar.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it definitely... I got that impression, and it sort of feels like increasingly BioWare has been going back to the well in terms of, like, kind of more popular, like, stuff. Like, I saw a lot of... In Dragon Age Inquisition, for example, it sure felt like they were borrowing heavily from Game of Thrones, the TV show, and Skyrim.
Yeah. But it wasn't necessarily the interesting stuff from Game of Thrones in the way that the first Dragon Age, which... Mm-hmm.
Which came up before...
Was released before the TV show.
Yes.
So it was based on the novels.
The show was in the works.
Not based on the novels.
Yes.
Yeah. So it was sort of running parallel to the show in terms of when it might have been developed and conceived and so on. And it's taking the interesting things about, like, the subversion of norms of how stories should work that Game of Thrones did so well, by killing the heroic character at the beginning, and then everyone has to pick up the pieces after that. And that was what kind of gave it energy, and Inquisition was more, you know, within this already existing fantasy thing that didn't necessarily want to upset too much.
And that's the thing with Andromeda, is that I was talking about how the original races, like the Krogan and the Turians and the Asari, like, kind of overwhelm everything. And I think that that's because, like, they have a really, like, great established foundation. And if this impressed anything on me, it was that the dynamics between these races are generally very interesting. The conflicts between these races are generally very interesting. And while they don't really do anything new with them, like, at all, like, the Krogan are still cranky, you know, the Asari are still kind of space elves, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, there's no, like, particularly interesting bit of world building. Like, it did impress upon me that even though it's kind of, you know, standard science fiction, in a lot of ways, Mass Effect was so executed so well that it became more than the sum of its parts.
Yeah, and some of this is, I'm kind of hoping to write about this, though I'm not sure if I will manage to get it published somewhere. Some of it is just, like, accidental. When I go back to Mass Effect 1 and I'm, like, having these initial conversations with Tali and Rex, who kind of stand in for the Quarians and the Krogan, who eventually become the most interesting part of that universe.
Yes.
A lot of what is interesting about them seems to be just like the writers said, okay, you have to go talk to these characters and they'll tell you about their people. Why are their people the way they are? Here are the dialogue responses that they get to that, and then those dialogue responses that, you know, you can get done in 5 minutes, but they're also an interesting kind of science fiction progression. Why is Tali in the suit? Why is Rex so cranky? Why haven't the Krogan taken over the galaxy, given how strong Rex is? Those responses to just kind of, what are these things? Why are they here? Become the centerpieces of Mass Effect 3, these grand climactic resolutions that are the best part of that game. And it's just kind of we are giving the time and weight and attention to these things over time, over the course of 3 games, serializing that in a way that, even if it's kind of boring initially, which I'm not sure is the case with those two, but might have been the case with, like, the Asari and the Turians, will eventually become some kind of interesting, just because they've put the time and energy into it. And Andromeda feels a little like they're taking that as a shortcut.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they do some things with the Angara that I should say that it's an interesting premise. I will say what they do with the Angara. But I sort of feel like it is only introduced. It is not really thoroughly explored, and I expect that it might be explored in a sequel at some point. Yeah, like, it would be a lot more interesting if they went a lot more into kind of depth in it. And that is kind of where I feel like some of the influences I was referring to earlier came into play. But like I said, it is so lightly touched upon that it, in a way, almost feels insignificant. And actually, the main quest is actually kind of brief. I was talking to our guides person the other day, and he was like, oh, God, yeah, I got so much more to play. Like, I'm here. And I'm like, oh, you're almost done. He's like, what?
That could happen. I felt that with Inquisition, too, where it felt like it climaxed at, like, 5-10 hours in, and then the rest of it was just kind of picking up the pieces. Mm. But this is kind of an issue with BioWare games generally, is that they've sort of struggled to have a strong overall conventional narrative arc in many, if not most, of their games.
I mean, Mass Effect 2 had an excellent arc for the most part.
Mass Effect 2 was... There were like 4 plot missions. Like,
yeah,
the rest of it is all collecting characters and then doing their loyalty quests, which is a really interesting structure.
Exactly.
Don't get me wrong, but if you're saying, what is the plot of Mass Effect 2? The plot of Mass Effect 2 is you find out who the collectors are, you get some stuff that lets you attack the collectors, you attack the collectors.
But it all culminates so well, and I mean, and you're being really reductive there. Like, I mean, it also, like, a huge part of it is your, like, unexpected relationship with Cerberus, and, like, how they, like, brought you back to life and all that stuff. Like, there is that component as well.
There's a bunch of cool stuff around it. Mm-hmm. I am pro Mass Effect 2. Like, I'm not saying that the plot is bad or whatever. I'm just saying that BioWare in general tends to structure their games in ways where the overarching plot is not necessarily the thing that drives you.
Mm-hmm.
With Mass Effect 1, I think it is. Mass Effect 1 is maybe the only one that actually has a villain.
Dragon Age Inquisition had a villain. Mass Effect Andromeda also has a villain.
Yeah, but Saren keeps trying to do things as you're playing Mass Effect 1. Dragon Age Inquisition, Corypheus is just kind of there after he destroys your initial base.
Sure.
It's just like, if we do these things, we beat Corypheus. We do these things, we beat Corypheus. Where Saren is kind of pushing things forward. And even going back, something like Baldur's Gate 2 is, you know, it's about the city that you're in and kind of figuring out what's going on in that city more than it is necessarily... I have to do all these main quest missions in order to do the next thing. And that's fine. I think that's an interesting thing. Like, the conventional BioWare thing is having, you know, you have one big quest that kind of gets your main story going, and then you have 4 hubs that you go to, each of which has a side story that kind of channels into the main story, but those side stories may be more interesting than the main story. Like I was talking about Mass Effect 1 as an example of this. Each of those side stories kind of refers to a classic bit of science fiction, and they all stand on their own relatively well, but they also add a little piece to the chasing Saren down puzzle. It's very rarely kind of a linear, we go here, we do this, very strong story. Mass Effect 3 did have that. Mass Effect 3 did have a strong main plot. But most of the rest don't. And that's fine. That's cool. It's good in RPGs to have that openness sometimes.
I suppose the last question I'm going to ask is, we've had the benefit, I mean, I think Mass Effect 3 came out 5 years ago now. We've had the benefit of kind of distance from the trilogy. Like, looking back on it, do you feel like it's kind of held up? And, like, has your opinion on it changed now that you had a chance to kind of replay it? Like, games have kind of progressed, that kind of thing?
I think Mass Effect 1 is increasingly difficult. It was always kind of difficult to get into. The inventory system and the unbalanced combat are real pains a lot of the time. I wrote a piece suggesting that if you want to try to get into the trilogy, start with Mass Effect 2. If you fall in love with the setting, then go back and play Mass Effect 1, because that's what'll get you through. If you don't fall in love with the setting, then I'm not sure why you would keep playing, but you can keep playing Mass Effect 2 if you want to be fine. As a kind of storytelling vehicle, Mass Effect 1 is still quite good, but it's just that inventory system and that combat are so janky that I just can't recommend bashing your head on it unless you have a very specific motivation to want to do that.
I mean, there's the PC version and mods.
Don't know what sorts of combat mods there are that might help, but if there are good ones, then that's probably recommendable. I used the Shiny Up mods to make all the faces all HD and stuff, but I did not check out any sorts of combat mods.
I remember when the original Mass Effect came out, like, looking at those people and going, oh my god, they look just like real people. Like, I can't tell the difference. And now maybe it's not quite the case. Like, Andromeda has notably poorer character models.
And Andromeda is weird because it's, like, half cartoonish, half realistic. It's, I don't know.
This is increasingly a thing with BioWare. Like, I don't know what the heck is going on with their art style. Like, they had a really hard time finding a good art style for Dragon Age.
I don't know. Maybe I'll come up with a stronger theory once I play more of Andromeda, but, like, when I was clicking through the multiplayer characters to check all of them out, see which, you know, classes and races they'd added in, I just thought how much stronger the Mass Effect 3 classes just, like, looked on the selection screen, versus the kind of 3D models that they had that are, they look nice and they look, like, competent and effective, but I don't get the same sort of, awesome, I have a Forcha soldier here who can set people on fire, and, like, I can get that feeling just from looking at the icon they put on the selection screen versus the full 3D model of an armored Krogan. Of course it's an armored Krogan, and I don't know. It's something that I will get used to and then either argue with or not at some point. Oh, this is something that I noticed that I haven't seen people talk about in their Andromeda reviews, is the music. I haven't really noticed the music of Andromeda.
I mean, it sounds like Mass Effect, but it did not stand out to me in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, but it sounds like Mass Effect without standing out is, like, most of the Mass Effect music does stand out.
Yes.
Or maybe not most of it, but significant.
Well, it has that. I mean, it's faithful to the Mass Effect music, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, you're right. When I was writing my essay about the Mass Effect 2 suicide mission, I watched the entirety of it, like, again on YouTube, and
that is the music.
Yeah, my God! Like, the music was so intense. Like, from the moment that you go through the Omega 4 relay or whatever, and you're, like, really tense. You're like, oh man, here we go. What am I gonna find? And then you get to the end of it, and, like, the way that the ambient music changes, like, perfectly to emphasize, like, the fear and the mystery of the space that you're in, like, it's just so perfect. But then, you know, it ramps up again really quickly during the action sequences as you're being chased to the collector base. And then from that point on, like, they basically hit the accelerator and don't stop. I mean, oh, God, so good.
Yeah, it's... and this is... Just as a side note, one of the reasons I think Mass Effect 2 is the most generally beloved is that it starts and ends really, really well.
Really,
like, a lot of the stuff in the middle is not terribly well designed.
That's all people remember is the beginning and the end.
Right. Whereas Mass Effect 3, the beginning and the end are easily the worst parts.
Yes, I know. Mass Effect 3, like, actually kind of bored the heck out of me at the beginning.
Yeah, the sequence on Earth is just a bunch of cliches and boredom just thrown at the wall, and helps set up just a lot of the mistakes that the ending makes, which we don't have to go into, but we can if you really want. Like, this is something that I also noticed with Inquisition, was that it had a really strong main theme. The scene with the people all singing the hymn, that's the main theme, was really good. But apart from that, I can't remember the music at all. And then there's a point when you run into your old character from Dragon Age 2, that the Dragon Age 2 music kicks in, and I'm just like, oh my god, this is so much better. Immediately gives me all the emotions that I'm not getting from the rest of Inquisition. And I'm wondering, and I'm kind of getting that feeling from what I've heard of Andromeda's music, which is that it sounds like Mass Effect music, but it's not trying to be in any way strongly melodic or intrusive. It's sort of following the kind of film music trend of the last decade or two, where you don't have these big, huge, dramatic themes. You have just kind of incidental background music that goes along with what you're supposed to be thinking.
Yep, hate it. because
yeah.
so much of my favorite media, like, that I just, like, stands out strongly in my mind, it's because of the music. Like, when the music starts, I know that something is going to happen, right? Like, I was watching Star Trek II the other day. Oh my god, James Horner's soundtrack in that movie was, like, unbelievable. And then right after that, like, Ratatouille came on, and the soundtrack on that movie is unbelievable. I don't think it's any coincidence that most of my favorite games have just phenomenal soundtracks. So it's, I do not like when games have pursued this, well, let's just have this kind of really quiet, like, in the background film score kind of approach.
Yeah, especially with the BioWare game,
mm-hmm.
Or any kind of grand RPG, like when I talk about that possibility space thing, one of the things that gets people into motivated to do that is music, if it gets them in the mood to do it. With the Mass Effect 1, you had that really cool, spacey, upbeat soundtrack that was just, like, felt exactly right for the kind of, this is a really cool galaxy for you to explore. Mass Effect 2 had this big, bombastic, dramatic music in the big, bombastic, dramatic scenes, and that worked really well, too. And Mass Effect 3, this is part of what I wrote about, I didn't include the music in this, but it probably should have, is that it got the music right when it needed to. It really hit, like, okay, here is the sad scenes, here are the upbeat scenes, and I think the technology they were using to have the music come in and out at exactly the right points, you know, was kind of perfected in Mass Effect 3. And the Andromeda, I just haven't noticed the music yet, except when I sit down and say, I'm going to listen to this music, and, like, the exploring the galaxy theme is almost exactly the same as the exploring the galaxy theme in Mass Effect 1, except it's quieter and subtler. And I don't necessarily want quieter and subtler in my big bombastic RPGs.
Indeed. Yeah, and Mass Effect Andromeda, like, certainly has its moments where you feel like it should be a lot more bombastic. But, geez, at the end of the day, like, there are a lot of, like, little problems I have with that game that really pile up. I was playing it yesterday. Like, I was, like, completing a whole bunch of the side quests just to help our guides people out, and all of the vault stuff I hate. Like, I hate everything to do with activating those, like, getting the glyphs from those stupid monoliths.
I did that for the first time, like, right as the last thing I did last night. Mm-hmm. And was not a huge fan. I like Sudoku, but
yeah,
no, that was,
but, I mean,
that's not the way I like
Sudoku. I can
Sudoku.
Do a Sudoku, it's fine, but, like, all of the crap around it is so boring. Like, collecting the glyphs, completing the Sudoku, going to the next damn monolith, going into the vault, completing a lot of very gamey, very, like, unimaginative puzzles that don't require a lot of thought. They're just, you know, kind of there. They're there to be time-consuming. And
right.
it's a real step back, in my opinion. And a lot of the combat, like, a lot of the combat itself feels mostly okay. Like, not amazing, but fine, like, in Mass Effect terms. But the encounter spaces are so underwhelming, like, especially the way that they handle cover is straight out of 2010. Like, it's not super great, and the enemies get really repetitive, like, really, 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 really repetitive, and it does a thing I hate where it'll introduce an enemy as a boss, but then they'll start, like, recycling that boss over and over again. It's just a rando enemy. Ugh. Do not like.
Not a fan of that?
No.
Hmm.
Especially when that boss is, like, particularly annoying to take down, as is the case with this boss. I think that if the boss is, like, at least really interesting and is introduced in an effective way, it could be a lot better. But most of the time, it does not work. And because, especially if it's the kind of boss where you have to take down a particular thing to be able to access its weak point to shoot the thing and do the thing, which is the case. Like, if it's just a really strong, I'm having a one-on-one battle with this, like, elite enemy, I think that can work a lot better. But in the cases where, as I described, you're doing, like, very specific step-by-step things and you're in the middle of a firefight, it's just a pain in the ass. It's not actually compelling.
Yeah, I think the whole jumping around thing probably makes it really hard to design interesting levels. Like, it's a cool feeling to jump around, land, smash a guy, whatever, but it's... you don't get that sort of methodical take the enemies out while you're avoiding being flanked thing that you got from Mass Effect 3 specifically. It feels like it's kind of leaning into how Mass Effect 3's multiplayer felt like after a few months, where you had people who knew exactly how everything worked and had the most powerful weapons and would just run around and zap things in the right place all the time. And it feels like they made this combat kind of for those people, as opposed to the, you know, sit down, take cover, work your way through things, very tactical kind of cover combat system that it could be in Mass Effect 2 and especially 3. One of the things you were saying before the combat, I think, struck me is all this kind of very gamey BS that I haven't encountered that much, but I have seen enough to think that you are probably right about it. How Mass Effect 3 streamlined the game to not have that gamey BS. It was like, this is what I was talking about when I mentioned that this felt like a sequel to Mass Effect 1 and not Mass Effect 3, is that, like, when you get into conversations with people, they're very slow-paced, I need to ask you everything conversations, as opposed to Mass Effect 3's kind of streamlined, all right, you're just having a quick little bit of banter with this person. You know, once you've done those things, then you're back in... Sorry, that was going nowhere. Once you've kind of gotten your investigation out of the way, where you know, how have you been? What has happened in the 2 years that I have been in prison? Blah, blah, blah. Then every conversation you have with a person is kind of just walk up and they, you know, mention something about the last mission, where this seems to be more... And, you know, again, I haven't spent too much time on the Tempest, so maybe that has this done better, but when I walk through the Nexus, it feels like Mass Effect 1, where every person I talk to, I get their life story, you know, one combat or one conversation selection at a time. And Mass Effect 3 streamlined the whole planetary scanning thing, where you're just... you're mostly trying to avoid the Reapers and grab one thing off each planet, and this one is a much slower planetary scanning system. There's still only one thing on the planets, it seems like, which is good, but it seems like it's very deliberately being deliberate about re-adding these kind of exploration and conversation things that were in Mass Effect 3, where, like, we know exactly the game we're doing. We're doing this big war epic. We're doing a very slow RPG that we don't necessarily know if all this fits together, when Mass Effect 3 was like, this fits together. This is how it fits together. We know what we're doing.
And the thing with the planetary scanning that drives me kind of crazy is that it takes so long to go from one planet to another. One thing I liked about Mass Effect 2 was that you would go into warp space or whatever, and you would see, like, a really cool shot, if I recall correctly, of the Normandy, the second Normandy, like going through the Mass Effect relay, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And it always looked really cool, right? And it lent the game a sense of momentum that is simply absent when you're traveling from planet to planet in Andromeda, because it'll, like, you'll go to a place, it'll zoom out, and then you'll, like, click over and you'll, like, select a place to scan, and then it'll go back to where you are, zoom in, but then zoom back out, and then slowly pan over to the other one, and then you can do the whole damn process again. And it made me completely allergic to scanning anything for the entire game.
It's not quite that slow, but it is... The sum of its parts ends up being slow. It's pretty fast from one planet to another, but you're still doing it every time you go from one planet to another. And yeah, it's a weird decision. I can kind of see what they're sort of trying to do. Like, it reminds me a little bit of the Mako in Mass Effect 1, which is, it's like, yeah, you're spending a lot of time driving to nowhere, but it's kind of saying, here is the grand scope of the galaxy as you're doing that. But this feels worse because you're not actually driving. You're just kind of watching a pseudo cutscene that shows how pretty their planets are. And, okay, you made a nice star system, but, you know, I can see nice star systems in a ton of, you know, strategy games or whatever, that you can go and click on each planet and look at it. And it's the sort of thing that I expect might be patched out. And maybe, like a lot of things from Dragon Age 2 that people complained about in reviews and were patched out, you know, 3 months later, that everyone who came to later found a much better game. They might have something like that happen with Andromeda, but I don't know.
Maybe you should release a complete game when it comes time to review, and people won't remember all the crap that you end up patching out later. But yeah, that's some of our thoughts on Mass Effect Andromeda. You can go read my review over on the site. Maybe we'll do more of a spoiler cast on it later. We never got around to doing our Final Fantasy XV spoiler cast, probably because we got busy. But, you know, we're going to have a couple months coming up here where things slow down a little bit. So in between our Persona 4 Golden and Persona 5 and God knows whatever else we're talking about, Final Fantasy 14 discussions, we might have a little time to dive a bit deeper into why exactly Mass Effect Andromeda's story really does not work. But in any case, this has been a US Gamer podcast. Acts of the Blood God can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. Go and subscribe, rate, review us. If you really enjoy the podcast, tell us why you like us. And every like positive review will make us a little bit more visible and the Blood God just that much happier. Of course, you can follow me on Twitter at @the_catbot. You can follow Nadia on Twitter at Nadia Oxford. And Rowan, you're at, was it Rowan Kaiser or is it something else?
Yep. It's at Rowan Kaiser.
All right. Yeah. Rowan has many strong opinions about things, especially RPGs. And if you are an RPG aficionado, I strongly recommend that you go follow his work.
And cats.
Yes, and cats. Rowan, where can we find you these days?
I am currently doing a piece for Polygon. I'm also doing some pieces for Zam lately, done a couple for you. Those are the three where it seems to be happening at the moment. I am sort of, having finished the book, getting back into publishing pieces more regularly, and we'll see where that takes me.
Excellent. And the book is about Game of Thrones, which, I mean, if you're a fan of the series, Rowan seems to know a lot about Game of Thrones, so you should check it out. And I'm looking forward to your Mass Effect book when it gets done. Having never written a book myself and being horribly intimidated by the process, I can totally imagine.
It's
awful. I can totally understand how you get like completely bogged down and everything. So,
yeah, I would also definitely not recommend it while you are a editor-in-chief.
Oh, God, no. I don't need to toss a third job onto the pile. This is not an instance where I would be throwing it on the pile, as it were. But let's see. Next week, I think that we will be circling back on some of the topics that we've already been covered. Let's see. Persona 5. Like, we might be able to talk a little bit about Persona 5 next week. So that could be fun. Persona 5 is coming up rather rapidly. So, in any case, I've been Cat Bailey. Thanks for listening. And for Rowan and myself, we'll see you again next time. And until then, happy adventuring.
Persil sorgt schon seit 1907 für tiefenreine Wäsche, auch bei den Johnsons. Oder Anna? Das stimmt. Sogar meine Oma hat schon mit Persil gewaschen.
Und als Dankeschön für über 100 Jahre Vertrauen gibt's jetzt bis zu 15 Euro Rabatt auf unser Bestes.
Das mit der roten Schleife.
Genau, made in Germany. Mehr Infos auf unserbestes.persil.de.
Wenn es tiefenrein ist, ist es Persil. Unser